Good morning. It's great to be here. Thank you, Pastor Alistair, for the invitation. What I'd like to do this morning is bring you a voice from the Middle East. A lot is happening in the Middle East, and you get a lot through the media. But the media does not tell you what God is doing in the Middle East. So I'd like to bring a voice from the Middle East. I understand that you've been going through passages in Genesis and looking at the theme of sin. And the consequences of sin are just awful. Hatred and violence and hostilities. And we have all of that happening right now in front of us in the Middle East. What I'd like to go through this morning is some attitudes that lead to hatred and violence and hostilities. What causes people to do that? I want to build a little bit on some work done by a person called Salim Nair, and I understand this morning that Salim was here a few weeks ago, maybe in a midweek service. Salim is an Arab-Palestinian, and he has a reconciliation ministry between Palestinians and Jews, and they're doing amazing work. And in his academic work, Salim has identified 8 attitudes that lead to hostility and hatred. So I'd like to go through them with you. The first attitude that Salim talks about is the us and them mentality. It's when conflict becomes an existential one. Individuals, they tend to evaluate their own groups with sensitivity and favor. We're able to understand our own group. We are able to see the values of our own group. We can recognize our own good qualities. We become attached to who we are. But we overlook our shortcomings because it's important for us to distinguish between us and them. We're the good and they're the bad. We're the good and they're the evil. We are those that are right and merciful and good. They are the ones that are evil. They are wrong. So it's easy for us to blame them when we have that kind of attitude. The second attitude that Salim talks about is the attitude of dehumanization. When we don't see the other as people created in image and likeness of God, but we see them as the enemy. And this really limits how we see one another. And this happens a lot in our part of the world. We don't look at people as these are people with good qualities and they happen to disagree with us, but we look at them as enemies. The third attitude that Salim talks about is the failure to see plurality within the other side. Is when we tend to stereotype the others. It becomes more difficult to understand them because instead of recognizing their own good qualities, we tend to generalize, we tend to stereotype. We say things like, they all hate us, they all want to kill us, they're all terrorists, they all think like that, they all behave like that, they're all evil. We're unable to see them as individuals with unique feelings, with unique thoughts as God created them. And that usually leads to the fourth attitude that Salim talks about, which is the attitude of suspicion. We think that others always have ulterior motives. So we think that they're all evil, they're all bad, but even if one of them does something good, then there must be an ulterior motive. They must have an agenda for doing something that appears to be good. They can't do anything good. They're not decent. They cannot be what they're behaving. They must have some other agenda. So we tend to develop a conspiracy complex, anticipating that they are all conspiring to harm us. So even if we see something good coming out of that camp, then they must have an ulterior motive for doing that. The fifth attitude is the self-fulfilling prophecy, is when we project an image on the others, and that image provokes them to behave accordingly. So, for example, if we believe that they only act with violence, then we're sort of forcing them to act with violence. So every time we think of certain group that this is, we put them in a box, and this is the way we expect them to behave, and then they start to behave according to that box. The sixth attitude that Salim talks about is that of moral superiority. We are the more peace-loving, we are the more trustworthy, we are the honest. So we decide that we are the ones that love peace, and we are the ones that can be trusted with a solution. So our values become more of a moral authority, and we view with contempt those who have different values. So often we will not mix with those who do not share our moral standards, as they might change us or they might corrupt us. So this feeling of moral superiority allows for separation and protection, and can even justify hatred or legitimize mistreatment of them. The seventh attitude is that of perceived victimization, is when we always see ourselves as victims. And we see that a lot among minorities in the Middle East, and especially Christians. We're victims. We're being attacked. We're always victimized. And we're unable to see ourselves as maybe a threat to others. So when we are victims, we cannot even perceive that we might be viewed as victimizers. We are the ones that are the victims. And this victim's mentality causes us to be blind to the others' pains, to their aspirations, to their needs. And therefore, it justifies attitude towards the other, this kind of hostile attitude. This perception of ourselves as the threatened and injured party always allows for fear and hostility towards the other. So violent action is justified. And some politicians, they use these kinds of fears to promote their own political agendas. And the last attitude, the eighth attitude that Salim talks about, is the attitude of dehumanization. So when we have a region where all the wars are happening in the name of God, then if God is on our side, it must be that the devil is on the other side. So we, both sides usually, they use religious language. So it shows the enemy as the instrument of the devil. So if God is on my side and devil is on their side, so they are beyond redemption. And therefore, violence is justified. We're having the fight against the enemies of God. So this justifies violence. So these are the eight attitudes that Salim talks about. Us and them mentality, dehumanization, stereotyping, failure to see the plurality within the other side, attitude of suspicion, self-fulfilling prophecy, moral superiority, perceived victimization, and demonization. So if we have that in our region, hatred and hostilities and violence and wars and conflicts, so what do we do? What does it mean to be agents of reconciliation, having the message of reconciliation and the ministry of reconciliation, as we just read in 2 Corinthians? Well, what is reconciliation? Derek Tidball, he used to be the principal of London School of Theology. This is the way he defined reconciliation. To reconcile is to bring enemies into a state of friendship, to overcome alienation, and to create affinity. It is to heal broken relationships so that those who have suffered them can put away the cause of their hostility and live in close harmony with one another from then on. Reconciliation is to face up to and resolve the cause of the disruption, realizing that only when the cause has been dealt with can true friendship be restored. So Derek Tidball here is saying that reconciliation, in order for reconciliation to happen, friendship needs to be restored. So both parties have to take part in this reconciliation. Desmond Tutu, a known peacemaker and holder of Nobel Peace Prize, takes the definition of reconciliation to a different level. This is what he says. If there is to be reconciliation, we who are ambassadors of Christ, we to whom the gospel of reconciliation has been entrusted, surely we must be Christ's instruments of peace. We must ourselves be reconciled. The victims of injustice and oppression must be ever ready to forgive. That is the gospel imperative. But those who have done wrong must be ready to say, we are sorry, forgive us, and the wrong must forgive. So what Desmond Tutu is saying, that reconciliation is the imperative of us. We have the ministry of reconciliation. However, the other party, they need to say, we are sorry, forgive us, so that we can forgive them. So reconciliation is our job. However, it's still conditional of them asking for forgiveness. Miroslav Volf, he's an East European theologian. He takes the definition of reconciliation even to a much higher level. This is what he says. At the core of the Christian faith lies the persuasion that the others need not be perceived as innocent in order to be loved, but ought to be embraced even when they are perceived as wrongdoers. So what he's saying is that we have the job of reconciliation, and it is not conditional. They don't have to be innocent, perceived as innocent, in order to be loved. We ought to love them even if they're not innocent. We ought to embrace them even when they are perceived as wrongdoers. So this is the definition that Miroslav Volf has taken reconciliation to, the level where this is really a gospel imperative, and it's not conditional. We have the message of reconciliation. Well, is this right? Is this true? Whose responsibility is really reconciliation? In our part of the world, we have three religions, right? Judaism, Islam, and Christianity. Well, there's no theology of reconciliation in Judaism. There's no theology of reconciliation in Islam. But in Christianity, the theology of reconciliation is at the very heart of the Christian faith. And we don't need to look far in our Bible to find basis for reconciliation, right? Even if you go back to creation, you're going through Genesis. We are all equally created in the image and likeness of God. So ontologically, we are God's children. Functionally, we ought to behave as God's children. And this by itself should counter the dehumanizing and demonizing attitudes. Just if we think that we ought to behave like God's children, and everyone else is created in the image and likeness of God, that by itself should counter the dehumanizing and demonizing attitudes. And if we take it to the cross, well, we see God's love manifested at the cross, don't we? In 1 John 4, talks about God's love. It's his identity. Love is from God. It's his actions. He loved us and sent his Son as an atoning sacrifice for our sins. He loves and embraces a world that really rebels against him. We think that we are the favored people. We are his children. We forget that we really rebelled when he loved us, and we still do many times. And we forget that God's grace extends not just to us, but to our enemies as well. God's grace is not just for us. It's for our enemies as well. And Jesus identified with that. He has anointed me to set at liberty those who are oppressed. Jesus came to liberate those who are oppressed. He came to bring deliverance, spiritual, social, physical, everything. And Jesus came to transform identity. The second passage that talks a lot about reconciliation in the New Testament is Ephesians 2, where it talks about bringing near through the blood of Christ those who were far, Jews and Gentiles, and all the difference between them and the boundaries, and then suddenly they become one. As people are reconciled to God, they get reconciled to one another. So how does reconciliation occur? Who does reconciliation? And it's interesting in the Ephesians passage, when Paul is talking about reconciliation, then he goes into chapter 3 and talks about his own role in apostleship. And then there's an interesting phrase that I love in Ephesians 3:10, through the church. So he's identifying these are the agents of reconciliation. These are the ambassadors for Christ. These are the witnesses for kingdom. It's the church. We are the ones that are called to be ambassadors. We are the ones that are called to live out kingdom values. And in a sense, reconciliation is peacemaking, isn't it? Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called the children of God. We find that in the Beatitudes. Daniel Buttrey, an American peacemaker, he makes a distinction between peacemaking and peacekeeping. A peacemaker is not a peacekeeper. A peacekeeper is someone who stays out of trouble, someone who just wants to mind his own business or her own business and just stay out of trouble. A peacemaker, however, is someone who steps into trouble. A peacemaker goes where there is no peace, into the conflict, into the war, into the web of violence, into the mess to try and clean things up, to bring healing. Isn't this what God did? God did not stay up there aloof in heaven, keeping peace for himself far removed from our messed up planet. That's not what he did. Instead, he came among us, into our mess, into our flesh, into our sinful, violent world. That's what Jesus did. The Son of God was revealed for this purpose, to destroy the works of the devil, 1 John 3:8. War and conflict are the works of the devil. Jesus came to destroy the works of the devil. So, these are heavy words for someone like me who grew up in the Middle East, and we have to face these kinds of attitudes all the time. And these eight attitudes that Salim talked about, we don't just find them among the other, but we find them among themselves, among ourselves many, many times. This is one of the problems that we have to reflect very hard. We have to hold the Bible as a mirror and look at it and see how are we behaving. And then how can we be agents of reconciliation when we're suffering from this hostility, and when we are, many times we feel that we're victims of this violence and this war? That's very, very difficult. But God's really teaching us lessons, and we're learning so many lessons out of the war. and out of the humanitarian crisis that we are facing right now, with the Syrian refugees, for example, with the war in Iraq, and even with the different wars in Lebanon and the area. You probably know we have more than 1.5 million Syrian refugees in Lebanon right now. Imagine the numbers. The population of Lebanon is 4 million. So out of 4 million population, we have an additional 1.5 million Syrian refugees. So you can imagine the tension that's causing. Well, that's not all, but the Syrians have been the other for us for the longest time. Lebanese hate Syrians, especially because of their interference in the Lebanese civil war, 1975 through 1990. And the majority of Syrians, 90% of Syrians, are Muslims. And Lebanese Christians, they hated Muslims and they hated Syrian Muslims. So imagine that now the majority of the refugees that are coming into Lebanon are Syrian Muslims, and now where they're finding caring environments and people that are embracing them are the Christian churches. What's happening in our churches? Our churches in the majority Muslim world, what happens is we grow up very much in survival mode, just wanting to be left alone, peacekeepers, not peacemakers, just want to be left alone. And ministry becomes about self-care and about caring for our own, and just about our own congregation. Then suddenly, God brings to us people that we used to hate. So it's interesting that we see God teaching so many lessons, and transformation is happening among the churches, turning into loving communities, turning into agents of peace and reconciliation, turning into peacemakers, turning into people that are caring for the other. At the same time, those that are coming, the majority of them are hearing the gospel message for the first time in their lives. So out of this evil, out of this mess, something amazing is happening. That's what you don't hear on the news. People are coming to church, and people are coming to faith, and people are hearing the gospel message for the first time in their lives. We have a prayer event about once a month at our seminary, organized by a group of young people, and they pray for Lebanon and Syria and the region. And during one of the recent meetings, one of young Syrian leaders, he stood up and said a very bold statement. He said, "I believe the war in Syria is an answer to prayer." Imagine that. Despite everything bad and evil that's happening, he says that, "I believe this is a result of prayer." Why? What's happening there? The churches in Syria, just like Lebanon, were almost dead, divided, just minding their own business, caring for themselves and nothing else. And suddenly they woke up. They have something that they need to deliver. They are the ambassadors for Christ. They are the agents of peace and reconciliation. They are the agents of hope. They are the agents of the kingdom. They are the ones that should have a prophetic voice to boldly proclaim the gospel in a time that's very much needed, and people need to hear that. I don't believe that God causes evil to happen, like what's happening in Syria and Iraq and Lebanon, but I believe that God does what he does best, is he redeems bad situations and something good comes out of them. And something amazing is coming out of them. They are people who need reconciliation. They are people who have heard about Christ for the first time in their lives. They are people who need to hear the gospel message, and if we don't initiate that ministry of reconciliation, then they will never hear that about Christ and about the gospel and about reconciliation. Yes, there is a problem of radicalism in our part of the world, for sure, definitely. But it's easy for us to stereotype them. And you hear that a lot, especially over Western media, that there's this big fear of Islam. I travel to the States a lot, and the media is trying to play a lot on people's fears, fear of Islam. Well, how helpful is that? You know, our problem is with 1.6 billion people, billion Muslims. Don't you find it interesting that ISIS said that they built this ideal Islamic state for Muslims? This is their ideal state for Muslims to come. And Muslims are running away to Europe. Instead of going east, they're going west. So don't you find this interesting? So maybe our problem is not with Islam or Muslims. Maybe our problem is with radicals. Maybe it's about radicalization. So instead of stereotyping all of them, they're all terrorists and they're all bad and they're all radicals, why don't we just try to discover what they're trying to say? Why not work with the moderates? Why not work with the moderates and give them a voice and give them a platform and start to give them a voice against the radicals. Right now, the radicals are the most vocal. Why don't we give a voice to the others? Why are they running to Europe? There's something happening there, and we need to be able to capture that. But the media, they like to play on people's fears. We should be bold with the message of reconciliation. And the question that's always being asked is, well, what's going to happen to Europe, for example, with all these thousands of people coming and refugees? Maybe it's a Trojan horse. Maybe there are some terrorists among them. Well, that's always a possibility. And definitely communities need to be diligent, and they need to do their work in protecting the communities. But that's not a reason to turn our backs against people who need to hear the gospel, people who need to hear the message of reconciliation. If God is sending them to us, there's a reason. There's a job that we ought to do. I often liken this to, for example, what happens in the States, that they have a challenge of shootings in schools every now and then. Well, the solution to stop shootings in school hasn't been to close down the schools. So if students don't come to school, then you don't have that problem. But we tend to think like that when we think about refugees. Well, let's close the door on refugees and we solve the problem. That's not how we solve the problem. We solve the problem by proclaiming the message of reconciliation. We shouldn't expect sinners not to sin. This is the only thing that they know how to do. But what should expect the church, we are the ambassadors for Christ, is to bring Christ to the communities, bring Christ to them. My time is up. There's so much to say. I can finish my sermon when you come to Lebanon. I'd like to extend an invitation to you. Come and visit. There's a lot to experience from what God is doing. God is doing amazing things. People think that Christians in the region are victims, and many feel that way, and they're trying to run away. Well, we're not. We're blessed to be in Lebanon right now at this critical time, where the church really is gaining its voice, where the church really is discovering its prophetic voice, discovering an element of the gospel that we've never seen before. It's very exciting to be there where people are coming to Christ in unprecedented numbers. Muslims are coming to faith in numbers that we've never seen before in recent history. It's very exciting what God is doing in that part of the world. So come alongside us and help us proclaim the gospel boldly. And thank you for this opportunity. Bless you.